Okay, folks, we're going to recommence. This is the working lunch to discuss ICANN's whistleblower program and board reconsideration process. We have with us Amy Stathos, ICANN's Deputy General Counsel, to walk us through those two topics. And we have, at this point, 45 minutes, but a little bit more if we needed Amy to discuss these issues. Thank you very much for coming. The floor is yours.
So, just to present, I didn't know if you had any specific questions based on if we want to start with the whistleblower program.
Yes, did you want to tee up your question? Okay. I'll paraphrase a question that came from Alan at a high level was. There appears to be some lack of visibility or lack of public visibility about the whistleblower program itself. And at a high level, the question is, if that is as it appears, why is that? Is there a rationale for that? And if so, can that be understood? Thanks.
Sure. There's really no intention to have a lack of visibility into the fact that we actually do have a program. And while we don't actually label it as whistleblower, we call it an anonymous hotline. By advice that we've in fact been given by counsel and HR fields, that it's actually more of a friendly wording so that people feel even more comfortable using that, because they know that if they use a hotline, they have the right to be completely anonymous. And some people who don't understand what a whistleblower might be or the whistleblower rules, which aren't, you know, mandated, as we are not, any kind of particular state actor or any kind or any of that, we have a program that's very much geared in the same manner. So that the program allows for people to call an anonymous hotline. We've got hotline numbers around the globe so that people, wherever they are in any of the ICANN offices, have an opportunity to call into the hotline. They have a choice. They can provide their name if they so choose, or they can remain completely anonymous. They can remain completely anonymous not only to ICANN staff, which are then would be tasked with investigating the complaint, or they can also remain completely anonymous with the independent third-party provider. It's really their choice as to whether they give their name to the third-party provider. But even if they do give their name to the third-party provider, there's no requirement, and it's their choice as to whether their name is then transmitted to ICANN staff in order to investigate the complaint. There is a committee that receives emails from the third-party provider as soon as a complaint comes in, and also a monthly regular reporting mechanism that those folks receive an email about. As soon as the email comes in, if there is an email that shows that a complaint had been provided, it gives particular information about what the issue is, any information that the reporter would choose to provide, any of the information that would allow us to investigate the complaint, because one certain clear criteria is that without the information necessary to investigate, it would be difficult for us to determine whether or not something is in fact amiss, and if so, how we go about rectifying any issues. There is no true limit to what the subject matter can be. As I think many people probably know, whistleblowers were initially instituted to weed out fraud, issues that are of that nature, but there's absolutely no limitation or no parameter set as to what could be accepted by the whistleblower third-party process. Of course, this feeds into some of our other policies for employees that have reporting mechanisms, that have requirements against fraud, and all the regular employee type of workplace requirements that employees must face in terms of making sure that they comply with all rules, laws, and regulations. The committee is made up of some folks who have the broad enough range within the committee or company in order to investigate without making it too broad so that it becomes company-wide. And so we've got both folks from the general counsel's office as well as somebody from HR in order to ensure that the employees are protected. And then with respect to the COO we have, because most of these things are operationally geared in terms of historical reporting to a whistleblower type hotline. And so that is the committee. Again, these people do not know who the complainant is unless the complainant chooses to provide that information. And then there's a full process, which I think the procedure was provided to the ATRT2, where we follow a process, and if it's something that needs immediate reaction, we have a timeline set where we meet within a less than 24-hour period. If it's something that is not urgent, that would not have to happen within 24 hours, we make sure that it was within a 7-day period. So that we can investigate and properly mitigate and correct any issues and then take any actions we need to ensure that the same issue does not happen again. I don't know how much detail you want me to go into that, Alan.
Amy, the question I was asking was not really on the substance of the program, but the level of confidentiality which surrounds the existence of the program and what its scope is and what the parameters and the processes are. Certainly some of us on this review team found it unusual that when we asked the question, instead of being able to go to the web and search, as you can for many similar programs programs for other organizations, we were told the chair of this committee should ask the CEO. And then the information would be assembled and sent to us. And that level of the confidentiality, the secrecy of the existence of the program, what its scope was, seems to be counter to the concept of things should be open unless there's a specific reason for being closed. And that was the core of my question, I guess.
Sure, Alan, thanks. And there is no confidentially around the fact that there is this process, what the scope of the process should be. And I think that if there is a perception of that, that it certainly is something that we can correct. I don't anticipate there should be any issues with the transparency of the fact that we have this process. It has been made public in the past. There have been questions about it. So I agree with you that it's something that there's no need to have. It should be transparent.
And yet the fact that we were told by a senior person that the chair had to go to the CEO, otherwise you couldn't release anything, is part of the issue here.
Avery.
Hi, thank you. Avery speaking. One of the questions I guess I had is, this has been in operation now for several years. I don't know if I read one of the reports we got right saying that there hadn't been but one or no actual reports of issues. Because, I mean, the first thing I had gone looking for is, assuming there is a program, what sort of, and normally I don't look for metrics, but in this case, what sort of reports had there been? What sort of issues had been brought up? What what sort of dispositions had there been for things? Had there been any issues where there was retaliation against an employee? And part of what had brought up the question for me is, you know, when you looked at some of the other reports that people were making, the things that did become public in like Domain Insight and other places, where people seemed to be reacting as if there was no internal safe way to do this whistleblowing, and when people did bring reports of problems, there seemed to be some form of possible retaliation. So one of the things that I was looking for was certain evidence that people had a program that they used, that there was a yearly sort of reporting of, we had 6 problems reported during the year of the various types, etc. Again, not going into the confidentiality of who reported or which manager was reported on or anything, but just there's sort of no reports coming out of it. And then when sort of got the impression that there had been actual no reports or very few reports, that again raises sort of an alarm bell of, well, everybody's got something to report, that no company's ever perfect, no company, you know, no set of relationships is ever perfect in that respect. So if it's not being used, why isn't it being used? Other than, well, we're perfect and nothing goes wrong. But and that was something that I was really having difficulty with, because we were seeing some external reports. We've also seen some perhaps confidential reports. And yet there's nothing in the whistleblower program, and that didn't quite connect.
Well, all I can really talk about is the existence of the system and the information that we've made available to employees. I don't know that I can actually opine as to why they're not using it.
It is correct that it isn't being used, right?
It is not being used extensively in any way. You're absolutely right. And I think there is one recent, the letter that was made public with respect to the employment situation, I don't know why they did not use the hotline system for that. I can't opine as to why people take action in the way they do. All I can say is that it has been in place since 2009. It's been tested, so it actually, the process works. Annually, every staff member must review that particular policy and acknowledge that they have read it and understand it and recognize it. The information about it is posted in all of our offices in public areas so that people know how to reach and utilize the system. And so it's definitely there. It's available. It's anonymous, but I can't opine as to why people do or don't use it.
Right. Thank you. Can I ask a follow-up? I understand that. One of the things, though, that sort of surprises me, for example, we have a yearly ombudsman report that, I guess, whether it's part of the annual report or just coincident with the annual report, I'm wondering, was there a decision made ever on why this shouldn't be reported on annually? It would seem from the One World Trust indication that there should be such a program built, that they did also advocate sort of a yearly, and in fact it would be a very good thing to be able to advise, we have such a program and nobody felt the need to use it this year. And so I quite, you know, I think that's the other half of Alan's question, is not only do we not know about the report, I mean the program, but if it is an indicator of a really open, successful, non-problem company, why isn't that being reported on a yearly basis? Is there a reason for not putting a section in the yearly report that says, we have an anonymous hotline for exactly this, brief description of what it's like, and there were 0 reports this year?
So to answer your question, no, there was not any actually discussion about whether there should or shouldn't be public reporting. I actually don't see that there would be an issue with that. I mean, I think, you know, it's something we should certainly consider.
Thank you. Alan?
I would hope also that such a report would include, you know, a rough statistic of how many of the reports were dismissed as being, you know, inappropriate and how many were acted on and caused changes in the organization. I don't think you reported that for the one incident that did exist. Company scuttlebutt spreads a lot quicker than a lot of other things. And, you know, although you can't, you know, identify why no one uses it, and we certainly can't, I bet you other people could. And there needs to be conviction that it's really working or that something like this is really working, because in the absence of that, the presumption is every rumor is true. You know, that someone might choose to report if they thought there was an effective mechanism for reporting it, that kind of thing. And that hurts IGAN's credibility.
Any other comments? Okay, seeing no hands, Amy, thank you for that. Yes, Olivier.
Thank you very much, Brian. Olivier Krepanovlo for the transcript. Looking at the process here, could you just remind me who the hotline committee is? Are these the chief operating officer, general counsel, and secretary?
Yes, and the deputy general counsel, who is responsible for HR matters from a legal standpoint. So there's four members.
Okay, thank you. So are there any safeguards in place if the complaint or issue involves directly one of these people on the committee?
Absolutely, and I think it's in the procedure. There are specific safeguards so that all four parties will receive a notification, and to the extent that it is about one, there's a process with the third-party provider whereby that the party who may be at the topic of the complaint or report will be removed from that process. And there's also a safeguard where if any one member of the committee goes to the provider to try to see if the provider could ask the reporter additional questions, that has to be more than one person, and it has to be copied to everybody in the committee, so it's not as if one of the four members on the committee who might be the subject matter of the complaint might want to try to somehow ask questions to figure out who it might be, they will not be able to do so without everybody else understanding and knowing that that's happening. So there are safeguards, and as soon as any report that comes in that's about one of those people, that they will be taken out of the loop and they will not have any access to any of the information available.
Okay, thank you, it's Olivia again. And so does the external provider of services, the anonymous hotline, have any observation power of some sort to ensure that the process is that's pursued is being fair, or that doesn't involve maybe a collusion of those people to cover up?
I'm not really sure what you mean.
I'm looking at an independent third eye, independent eye that would be looking at how the process is pursued. We're all dealing here. I mean, the whistleblower policy here is all being done in-house at ICANN. And if there isn't.
No, it's a third-party provider, an outside third-party provider that receives the reports, that takes the intake of all the complaints, and then they notify ICANN staff, the committee, what the issues are. So it doesn't come into ICANN. It's actually a contracted third party.
Okay, but their mission ends as soon as it has notified ICANN.
No, they participate throughout the process because there's often times when you have to go back and ask additional clarifying questions. So they act as the conduit and the liaison to the reporter if the reporter is allowing them to do so, so that there's additional information that can be provided. In terms of at the very end, I mean, they don't have a say in what happens.
Right, so my question was, I guess I should focus on it. Then my question was, who is the shepherd of the process? It's not that external organization. They just act as a conduit or as a buffer between the complainant and ICANN.
That's right.
Who shepherds the process?
The committee as a whole.
Carlos.
This is Carlos for the record. Is it strictly for ICANN staff, or can I use it to complain about the chair of ALAC, for example, or somebody I don't like?
No, the policy that we do have is limited to ICANN staff.
Aubrey.
Yeah, thank you. I had another couple questions. One is, why is the third-party company also kept secret? Two is, has there been sort of any periodic review as standards in anonymous hotlines or whistleblowers change over time to review it? And third, was there ever any consideration given to actually including some sort of employee rep as opposed to only bosses on such a committee?
The first question, you went through three. You can only give me two at a time, Aubrey.
Oh, okay. I can come back and then raise my hand again for the third. I had actually, when I put my hand up, only had two, but then a third one had occurred to me. The first two was, while I understand not making the phone numbers public, because then anybody could call about anything, and I'm not sure there's an issue there, but the identity of the third-party provider is something that you also felt was necessary to redact. And I'm wondering what would be the reason for that as an independent third-party provider. Why would their identities need to be kept secret? That seems like something that shouldn't need to be secret, or I don't understand it anyway.
Well, the reason those were redacted is because the provider and the numbers go hand in hand. The idea was that this is for employees, and so both were redacted so that there wouldn't be people randomly calling up the provider and saying, well, I have a complaint about this, and without having the actual employee number, they would still take the complaint, and then that could be something that would promulgate over time. So we wanted to keep it to an employee-only process, and therefore both the provider as well as the numbers have been redacted. That was the rationale behind it. In terms of the third question, I think, which is why are there only bosses and not staff, I think the Deputy General Counsel will appreciate that they're not considered just regular staff. But this was a process whereby the person who's in HR is responsible for ensuring that the employees are protected in the process. There are the other two officers, and then the Deputy General Counsel maintain the privilege. The issue was to make sure that any issue is contained until it becomes something that needs to be rectified and mitigated and then made public. So the process was to try to contain it within, officers and the HR department and then under privilege in order to make sure that we investigate it correctly and make sure that there aren't any undue risks associated with the complaint until it is determined that it, in fact, is a valid complaint and actions do need to be taken to rectify the issue.
Yeah, just as a side, as someone that spent a lot of time as an employee in a company, the HR people are the last that one trusts with any issue because it always gets you in trouble. And that's just something that's an experience with my life, that you never go to the HR when you've got a problem because it's sure to be reported to your manager before you've actually even gotten out of the office. And I know that's just folk nonsense, but it's a pervasive view. The other question I had is just, is there an attempt made as whistleblower sort of practice has been refined, and that to review this program on a periodic basis to make sure that it is open, and to look at the fact that, oops, we only had one report. What are we doing right? What are we doing wrong to make sure that isn't in itself an indicator?
We do regularly evaluate this, as we do with all the employee policies and procedures, to make sure that they are consistent with current law, to make sure that they are as consistent with best practices as they can be. And we are do that at least every 2 years, and we try every year to do that with all of our policies. In terms of the looking at that there has been only one report, yes, we constantly look at that and see if there's something else that there's an issue. And the most that we can do is continue to educate, and which is what we try to do, and annually require folks to be aware and understand and to have the information available 24/7 in the offices.
Thank you. Any other questions on the whistleblower program? We have the balance of the time, if you don't mind, to speak about the reconsideration process.
Sure.
Thank you.
If there are any specific questions, or should I just talk through
any specific
where
questions,
we are?
Or why don't you start with an overview?
Okay. So, as I know, the ATRT1 was very focused on the accountability processes, in particular the reconsideration process and the independent review process. As part of the report that the ATRT1 issued and recommendations from that report, there was a thorough review of both of those mechanisms done by a group of experts. Of both dispute resolution as well as corporate governance. That process led to some significant changes in the reconsideration process over time. As to go back in terms of a threshold of what the reconsideration process is, our bylaws call for reconsideration of any matters, either actions or inactions taken by staff, that may be inconsistent with an ICANN established policy or process. And then there's also a review of actions or inactions taken by board that are done without necessary material information available to them. In terms of the overall specific requirements of that, those were not changed in the review process. But the panel did review the entire processes and determined that at this time, they should not throw out the process and start from scratch. The first order that they thought would be the best approach would be to try to make improvements to the reconsideration process, recognizing that it's a first step, and to have those processes tested as reviewed and revised. And then that may lead to further improvements over time. There is a list of several recommendations that they made. We called it the ASEP, which is the Accountability Structures Expert Panel. Their report was posted for public comment, and there were some changes made to their recommendations based on public comment. But there are some specific changes that were made to the reconsideration process that, while they've been in place for a while, they have not yet been tested significantly. And so we're still waiting to see if some of those improvements have any effect. In particular, one of the things that was added to a standard for review in terms of the access of the process is now claims for consideration of not only material information but inaccurate information that was used for a decision-making process is also something that can be reviewed under the reconsideration process. There were a lot of key terms that were not defined that they recommended and had added some clear definitions so that people accessing and using the processes understood what the terms meant. There were some time limits that were modified, an ability for an urgent review so that people can actually, rather than issuing a stay, let's just get on with it and do a quick review and make a decision to the extent that that's available and helpful to the person who's trying to access and seek reconsideration of an issue. They added the ability to make class filings, if you will, of a reconsideration process so that if more than one party feels that they've been affected by a decision, that they can get together and make one complaint and ask for reconsideration of a particular decision that's been made. There are some other procedural aspects that have been changed, and don't want to go into every single detail because I know we're running out of time here. And the mechanism that has been in place, the board approved in December of 2012 after a long review process, but it took effect in just in April. So the reconsiderations, there's really only one, and actually now the second one that have been filed that will be analyzed under the new revised terms and bylaws. So it's not really been tested yet. Neither one of those have come to a decision or even a recommendation from the BGC yet.
Thank you, Amy. Aubrey?
Thank you on this one. So the reconsideration is for any decision made by staff or board, not just board decisions. And I hadn't known that before. I thought it was just board decisions that were open. Was that one of the things that was changed, or has that always been the case?
It's always been the case.
Have there been any statistics kept on over time the number of reconsideration requests of which type and which have resulted in changes of action and such? And again, is that the sort of thing that belongs in something that's reported annually? And is there, I mean,
there is,
I'm asking questions I don't know the answer to.
No, there's an annual reconsideration report that's done and posted every year.
Okay.
And it has statistics in terms of the requests that are submitted, the issues that are at hand, the resolutions, all those things are part of the annual report.
Thank you. Can you another?
I was just wondering where this report is because it's not one that I've ever actually run across. So it's just I'm sure I didn't look in the right place.
It used to be on the Reconsideration Committee page, and I believe it is now on the BGC, which has taken over responsibility for the matters.
Thank you. Can you just expand for me a little bit this notion of inaccurate information as a basis? Is that known at the time, knowable at the time?
Actually, it's if the requester can show that the decision that the board or staff made was based on inaccurate information, whether they knew or did not know it was inaccurate at that time, then that is something that is subject to be reconsidered. Because you want to make sure that decisions are made based on accurate and complete information.
But it's a basis for triggering the process, not a determinant of the outcome.
Absolutely. It triggers a process so that the matter is reconsidered with excluding the inaccurate information and hopefully including the accurate information.
Thank you. Any other questions? Is anybody on the phone from the review team? No? Okay. Any other questions for Amy? Looks like not. Thank you very much.
Of course.
As always, if we have any follow-ups, we'll come back to you. On the whistleblower discussion, thank you for all that. We've given you some thoughts to take on board. If things evolve on that front or you take action based on this discussion, feel free to come back to us and give us an update on that so we can track that.
Will do. And thank you very much. I appreciate the questions. And as always, you guys get us thinking.
Thank you. Okay, we have, I think, about 10 minutes before our break. Unless somebody has a better idea. And when we come back from 2 o'clock to 2:30, and then that's item 9, not item 10, with the ICANN Ombudsman, that's being pushed off to tomorrow. So we're going to have a solid hour from 2:30 to 3:30. We'll come back to the questions to the community, as I said, offline in the break. Alvry, Allen, and I will clean those up and organize them. And I'll also use that hour to talk about concrete work that we need to do between now and Los Angeles. But for the next 10 minutes, since I know you have to disappear, Olivier, for the better part of the afternoon, would you mind giving us your overview of the progress of the work on Workstream 1? And I'm going to ask each of the chairs, what's most important in these reports is just absolute frankness. If things are going swimmingly and they're progressing well and you're making progress and you've learned how to do that, please share. If you are behind the curve, please say so, so we can identify what the problems are and we can address them. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Brian. It's Olivier Crépin-Leblanc for the record. Workstream 1 has been looking at the AOC sections 9.1A to E and has had an enormous amount of reading to do. Part of the work is to make good sense of the information that staff has provided us in a very large Excel document, and it's been very hard for many of us to be able to follow it due to the sheer size of it. And it's good in a way because the information is there. So staff has very kindly chopped this into sub-parts that fell under 9.1A and B and C and D. I've made a proposition to the working group itself to shrink that even further so as to have a table that can be printed and that we can work from at that point. And I've also made a suggestion that we use color coding so as to identify quite quickly which parts will need further work or further investigation. That's where we're at the moment, basically making sense of the information and making it easily accessible at a glance for us to be able to synthesize. I recognize we're still in a data capturing mode at the moment. If you do believe we need to go further than that, I'd be very open to suggestions, and of course the whole working stream would be happy to hear.
Thank you. Kind of jump the conversation from 2:30 a little bit. Do you feel you're in a position where the work stream could identify and articulate at a preliminary level recommendations of this standpoint at this point in time, or key issues that you know are going to be outputs of the work?
Negative.
Alan.
Are you worried about that?
Do I look worried? Yes, I certainly am. I think that there's a huge amount of work that needs to be done. I'm not quite sure how much of the reading has been done by the work stream. I know that we're all very busy and so on, and it's difficult to find out at this very time. I do hope that we're all up to scratch on this, because when we get going with the analysis, I would hope that people don't need to read the section in question, but would actually know about it there and then. One thing that has come out in my thoughts was to see that since we do have substreams in that work stream, we could task each one of the substreams to provide quick, maybe not today, of course, but in the next few weeks, provide a quick analysis of what segments of their work they believe is important to take forward. Looking at it, because we are chopping this into so many smaller bits, it's actually not that much work for each one of those substreams. And I would imagine that just spending a couple of hours on it would yield results just by sharing the load effectively.
Thank you. Before we break, and thank you for the report. We'll hear from the other workstream chairs, but we are at the end of July, or nearing the end of July. We're meeting at the end of August. We have an important week in front of us. We're going to get a lot of useful inputs from the community that we can factor into the work, but in terms of developing recommendations, and we begin writing them in Los Angeles, we really have about a four-week window between Durban and Los Angeles to get the work to a concrete place. What I'd like to do is provoke the team, and we'll put a document up on the screen a little bit later, to try to articulate now what are the likely recommendations, even if it's in very rough form, or what are the key points that you think are going to be part of your report coming out of that, and perhaps even putting some early drafts together before Los Angeles. We really need to move this process forward. I understand there's an awful lot of work, and it's in part because we have an existing base of reviews that we have to assess, which is itself a lot of work, and new issues that we've identified to take on. But this afternoon and tomorrow, we'll start taking concrete steps to putting thoughts on paper and getting draft recommendations in the works. So, hello, Lisa. Welcome. I think with that, you're just in time for the break. You and Steve have impeccable timing. Let's take the next 35 minutes for a break. The chair and vice chairs will organize the questions that we've identified for the community, and we'll be able to look at those on the screen, organized, targeted, and then start looking at work templates and development of recommendations in the hour that starts at 2 o'clock. So we're going to take a break for the next 35 minutes. Thank you.